Well, they're disassembling things over there. We'll prepare to move along in our discs and cylinders section. That one obviously was primarily about cylinders, although there was some discussion of discs in there, diamond discs and so on. So you know, there are connections there. This next presentation is principally disc-centered. So those, no pun intended, but I see that puns were detected. So those of us who like to scare people about the impending degradation of media, I mean, the lacquer disc really is our favorite candidate for putting the fear of God into people, really the equivalent of nitrate film for film preservationists. Maybe not quite as dramatic, but you'll often see these wonderful images of delaminating lacquer discs as the poster children for that message. But anybody who's spent much time working with lacquer discs knows that another significant problem that they display is this exudation of plasticizer. You pull these things out of the shelves and they look like someone's been rubbing a bar of soap over them or something like this. And so the presentation that is coming up next for us is a look at ways of getting rid of that stuff. So a methodical investigation of different solutions for removing that material. And our presenter will be Eric Breitung. He is a scientist in the Preservation Research and Testing Division at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. He earned a PhD in chemistry from the University of Wisconsin in 1999, worked at General Electric's R&D facility in upstate New York for 10 years in coatings and thin films, and began focusing on cultural heritage science in 2006 with a Mellon Fellowship at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. His presentation title is Cleaning Solutions for Heavily Degraded Lacquered Discs.
Yeah, so as indicated, I'm going to talk about lacquer disc exudation and sort of some of the work that we Okay, so lacquer discs exudation. Was working with Ellie Hartig over the summer last year. She was a fellow for about 10 weeks and is also a scientist. And we were basically sort of charged with coming up with solutions for cleaning this exudation off. I don't know how many of these we have in our collection, but I understand there are a lot. And a lot of them look like this. So they were, you know, the folks at Culpeper were willing to give me an entire box to look at and investigate. They ranged in levels of exudation, really from almost nothing to very very much covered with a white plasticizer. So the first thing we did was just to look and make sure that everybody was right, that it's fatty acids that are on the surface. So we just brushed some of the powder off and dissolved it in a solvent and put it into a mass spectrometer, which gave us this spectrum. And showed us that it's mostly these two fatty acids, palmitic and stearic acid. And they consistently showed up in this ratio where there's much less palmitic than there is stearic. And that will sort of become important later as we see how well these solutions we have work to dissolve these fatty acids. And as you may know, this comes from the breakdown of castor oil, the plasticizer, in these discs. And oddly, castor oil typically doesn't have a lot of these two fatty acids attached to. There would be three chains on one castor oil molecule. But it turns out that these are the ones that tend to migrate to the surface and form little white crystals, and that's what you're finding there. So we needed to come up with ways to clean these that were both safe for the surface and don't harm lacquered discs. So we did some residue tests, just put drops on the surface of a disc to see what it would do. Does it swell? Does it change the shape of the grooves? We looked at more mass spectroscopy to analyze the solutions after we contact the disc. Is the solution dissolving more than the fatty acids? Is it breaking down the nitrocellulose or any of the other chemicals that are in there? I think there are antioxidants, other chemicals that we wouldn't want to take out of the disc if we could avoid it. And then we did some microscopy to look and see if we could either use that to say one is working better than the other or whether the disc is modified in any way. And then we had a question of can we effectively remove this exudate with anything? And you'll sort of get the results for that. We did not do a look at every surfactant and every solution possibility, but we took a couple choices from sort of what people in the field seem to use, what's on the internet. And since I'm from the Library of Congress, I can't tell you exactly what commercial record cleaner I used. There aren't that many out there. They all have a non-ionic surfactant in them. They tend to use water as their solvent for that surfactant. And then the commercial cleaners have more stuff in them, which either change the pH a little bit or might complex metals or things like that. And then tergitol, which we used variations of, so it's this different sort of lengths of the non-ionic part of this would be the part that's the ball in my picture, and then the long chain is the hydrocarbon. And tergicatol 7 has a medium length of that, and then we had 9 and 3, which is the very long and then the very short version. And we've seen recipes on the web where people are mixing the 9 and the 3 together and then just using 7. A lot of this was, I mean, people use this for, as you know, just cleaning dirt off of vinyl discs, right? So I didn't remember to use the caveat that we are testing solutions primarily and only for looking at these lacquered exudates, that you wouldn't, you know, add ammonia to anything that you were just trying to clean some dirt off of. The ammonia is there to deprotonate the acids and hopefully bring those in and make them more water soluble. And I'll hopefully remember to talk about some alternatives to ammonia because it sort of smells and it evaporates after you make the solution. I will also say that, so since this was really just a survey at this point, and maybe the next slide says it, is that there are a lot of other surfactants that you can use. A lot of, you know, can change the concentration. You wouldn't want to go more than maybe a milliliter of these surfactants in this much water. But there are a lot of variables you could mess with. But the key ones in this case were ammonia, no ammonia, using a buffer. So you can use a buffer and it'll soak up more, should soak up more of the acids and not change the pH of the solution. So if you have way too much acid and it's not soaking it up, the pH will go down and the solubility of both your surfactant and the fatty acid you're trying to dissolve changes. So here's a list of just generally some surfactants that sort of have the right properties, which I won't go into, that you could try. And if we went further with this, and we may actually try to order all these and just do a quick run to see which ones work the best. You know, for instance, like ECO EH9, people use this in paper conservation. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to try it in this field. So getting around to the tests, the first thing we did was just a quick rinsing test to see if you took a drop of one of these solutions and let it dry on a small piece of glass, and that's what we're sort of showing here, and said, well, so you're cleaning this maybe on a Keith Monk's machine or something, and you leave a drop in a groove, how hard is it to get that drop out after it dries? And we also asked the question, if you just put it on wet and then try to rinse it off, how much does it take to rinse that off? And so this chart's mildly confusing. The Y means, yes, there is still residue present after you've rinsed it this many times. And then the S is there's some left, and N is there's none left. Red bad, green good kind of thing. And so the amount of volume that we used to rinse with was identical to the volume we used to deposit the drop. So it was in the level of microliters, a very small amount. So it wasn't like we're pouring water over this little glass slide. It was one little drop, let it sit there, and then put another drop to rinse it off, or let one drop, let it dry, and then a drop to rinse it off. So may seem impractical, but it was a way of sort of quantifying the differences between these. And so if you look at the wet rinse, which is hopefully more like what you guys are doing, most of them behave pretty well, that with a few rinses, you get to the point where there's no residue left. Very oddly to me, this Tergicol mix, the one where there was the 9 and the 3, was the one that behaved the most poorly both in wet and dry. So it may be forming sort of a gel. When you mix surfactants, you change that the point at which you make a micelle. It sort of can become a gel and other things. And so maybe that's what's happening here. I don't have any solid evidence for it other than this is odd. It should behave like Tergicol 7, but it's not. So for that reason, I wouldn't suggest, even if this dissolved these fatty acids fairly well, using this combination. And then the buffered record cleaner, which has a salt in it, basically, is what buffers are. You have a question? Yes? Say that one more time.
What are you using for the rinsing agent?
Oh, sorry. The rinsing agent is just water. Probably 18 megaohm, super pure water. Yeah, my apologies. And I should have said back here that these two are our sort of controls, where hexane isopropanol is a very good solvent for these fatty acids, but it's probably also a good solvent for the other things you don't want to dissolve out of the disc, unfortunately. And, you know, hexane, I think, attacks your liver. So you don't really want to use that much. And then water shouldn't work at all. So we use those as our two extreme controls. All right, where was I? Going the wrong way. Okay, so generally that was the key. So buffered, we'll find out whether it's necessary, but it was a little hard to rinse if it dries because it's a salt or has salts in it. The next thing was to just put the stuff on a disc itself and see what it does to both the exudate as well as the, you know, we'd find a bare or a disc that doesn't look like it had a lot of exudate and put it on there and test it. And so this is just a slide on how we accomplished that, because we weren't using large quantities, we weren't dipping it in a big vat of it. We wanted to be able to go back to a particular spot and analyze it with either a microscope or take that particular drop that we put on and pull it off and then analyze that drop. And so we use the system where we take an O-ring, and then this Petri dish is upside down. That is a hole in a little plastic Petri dish, and then we put a weight on it so that basically we trap the vapors, let it sit there for a minute or two, and then we could re-extract that drop and go back to this very exact points. This, by the way, is where the hexane isopropanol sat, right? So very good solvent for this stuff, unfortunately. So the first question, are we dissolving the disc? This isn't not the powder, but the disc itself. And this is an example with the commercial record cleaner that, back to the GCMS, we really just saw stearic acid and palmitic acid. And then these little peaks down here were the actual surfactants and things that were additives to the commercial record cleaner. So basically everything, we didn't see any degradation products from nitrocellulose. I don't even know that we would be able to detect those very well with mass spec, but it'd be surprising if anything would rip that apart that we were using. The things I was mostly worried about was dissolving the rest of the disc, the antioxidants, other additives that were in these things. And the only one that seemed to do that was really hexane isopropanol, which is why we don't really recommend using it. So there's the water-based surfactants with the non-ionics are safe to use on these discs. So now the question is, which ones work, and do they work on the discs? And note that we're just putting a drop on. We're not scrubbing it. We're not using a brush. We're not using excess of the stuff. We're just putting a very small amount in an area and then going back to that area to analyze it. And so the top row, you can't see it, but it says that this is the before pictures, and these are the after pictures for a disc that had a lot of exudate and some with medium. And the part that's sort of interesting to me on this is that you kind of can't see much difference between a heavily affected disc that's been treated with this stuff, except for hexane isopropanol. But with a moderately affected disc, there is a significant difference. And it's not clear to me that... We know we dissolved some fatty acids from these discs with all these cleaning solutions. But my gut is that the different discs can be have a different level of tenacity, or the surfactant can have a different level of tenacity with different types of discs. That's my best guess, but we didn't run enough of them for me to say that unequivocally. I can say that some of the surfactants worked and the water doesn't, right? So we know that these can be useful, and so this is qualitative. We basically know we're at least going down the right path. So now the question is can we quantify this in any way that's useful? And the only way to do that, so I guess I should say, obviously, these two areas are different. Even though they're on the same disc, I can't compare this test to this test. So I can't quantify that difference very easily. But I can do it here, where I take a known amount of that ratio of basically 30% to 70% of these two different fatty acids, dissolve those, or just put those in a vial, add a specific amount of each cleaner. One by one, vortexing is just spinning it, mixing it heavily for a little bit, which is basically 3 minutes or so. And then we place it on top of a filter, filter that using a centrifuge, and then take out a specific amount of what's left here for each one, and then adding an internal standard for a mass spec of hexanoic acid, and then we run mass specs. So if you're not familiar with mass spec, you might look at this and say, well, it looks like the lens cleaner and the record cleaner behave very similarly. But if you look at this noise floor, which you're familiar with, it's the same concept. This has a lot of noise, and you can't see this axis, but these numbers are much smaller than this. So this is really a very blown-up version. If I expanded way down here and blew that up, I would see something like this, except these peaks would be enormous. So this is a bit of me presenting it poorly, but I'm trying to explain the differences that basically this didn't dissolve much of the fatty acids, and this dissolved a ton of fatty acids. And so the way we quantify this is just to take the ratio between our one of these fatty acids and the internal standard in both cases. So if this was small, this will always sort of have the same intensity, and it makes up for differences in individual runs. So if there's something changes with my detector for this run, it's made up for by this internal standard peak. So the next chart is sort of the results from that, which probably the people in the back can't see, but I'll point out the important differences. So remember we talked about, is ammonia useful and important for getting rid of this stuff? And if you look at, say, this one, record cleaner, with no dilution, record cleaner, this is also no dilution with 1% of ammonia and 5% ammonia. What I found in the field is that people put sort of random amounts of ammonia in. And what we're finding is that there's no real difference between 5% and 1%. As a matter of fact, maybe 1% is better. And so I would argue don't put more than 1%. I think the old recommendation from the Library of Congress was 0.5%. So probably it's a good range, 0.5 to 1%, and I would say, do your own tests at your facility. And the other thing was that buffering seemed to improve it a little bit, but definitely not enough to be significant, especially considering that problem with rinsing, right? So, and we would also argue in this case that I chose a poor comparison surfactant of turgitol, and I didn't add any of those other additives that's in the commercial record cleaner. So, again, if we expanded this search to sort of developing our own record cleaner, we would add a lot of other variables to this scenario. The other unfortunate part with the one we made ourselves was that the mixture one, the turgitol mix with the 9 and the 3, performed better than turgitol 7, but then again, with the rinsing problem, you wouldn't recommend that. The lens cleaner was pathetic. There's almost nothing dissolved. Water would look... there are two actual little bars there, but water would look very similar. And then if you dilute that record cleaner, the same record cleaner, by, I think it's two parts of the cleaner to one water, it goes down to almost nothing. great for sort of dissolving dirt, a little bit of dust, wiping dust off the surface, but not for these fatty acids on the surface. Let's see if I got all the points. Oh, the surfactant and the concentration of that surfactant matter, so that's that comparison. Oh, and the other key is, and this is that whole 30% versus and 70% palmitic versus stearic, is that all of these surfactants prefer palmitic acid over stearic. It's a little surprising, but it's true. So, again, if you searched for a better surfactant scenario, you would look for one that preferred the stearic a little bit more because there's 70% of that versus 30% of the palmitic. So that's the story with the solutions. And now I had some extra time, so I sort of delved into the mechanics of how things, how people tend to clean heavy exudation. And one of the ways is to use sort of these mechanized record players with water and things on the surface, and they use brushes. And so I said, well, what are the brushes doing? Are they all the same? Are they different? And so, again, I can't tell you which ones they are, but I'm guessing you can tell by the pictures. And this one is part of a Keith Monk setup. The brush itself is actually the black plastic here, which I didn't take off, and then has the brushes on it. So I'm just sort of going to look at each one of these and sort of show you what the differences are, which I was kind of surprised by. But before we do that, let's look at what the grooves are. So obviously, if you're using a brush, you're probably trying to get into the grooves of the record. This is actually a picture of vinyl that I stole from the internet. They're measuring, this is an SEM cross-section, and this is about, 140 microns, and this is about 40 microns, something like that. And then I, with Peter Allier at the library, used the Irene system to just image a set of grooves on a few different disks, which was kind of great. And this is the data we got out, so it was sort of a new application for that device. But this would be the top of the groove, so this is upside down, and this is the bottom of the groove. And then the part in between, which is the angled part, or this part, doesn't reflect the light back up into the detector, and so that just zeroes out. So what you're looking at is top, bottom, so on and so forth. And that's where I got these numbers. And you look at these, and so let's just generalize that disks are between 120 and 200 or 170 microns wide, and there are 40 to 60 microns deep. Okay, so now you need a bristle that sort of mimics that, right? And so if we go through those three brushes, this one is kind of interesting. They had taken a piece of polymer, so this is, I believe, polyamide, the same stuff they make bulletproof vests out of, and sliced it at an angle like this to make tips that were pointed. And so I don't know if you can tell, but there's sort of a round piece here where you would get sort of the slice through a cylinder, right? And when they cut these or when they laid them into the brush, they're very even across the bottom. This doesn't quite show it because I'm trying to use a microscope to really focus on these two, but you'll see in the next couple of examples of the other brushes that this is very even across the bottom. And here's that same brush where I think you can see those circles a little better, or the ovals and the points. They're not sharp. It's still a rounded end, but they're shaped. And if you go 40 microns from the bottom and measure the distance across, it's about 115 microns wide. So if you remember from our chart, especially with lacquers, it's 140 microns wide and 40 microns deep. So I don't know if they did it on purpose. I kind of assume they did. But they did a pretty good job of matching the groove to at least be able to get to the point where you could scrape some of the sidewalls. You're not going to get all the way to the bottom of the groove. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, the ones with those handles on them.
The black ones?
The black ones, yeah.
Yeah.
I bought those back, I think, in the 70s.
Did they run out?
Yeah. Yeah, the newer ones, apparently Jonathan, his son, had the wooden ones. He said he claims the brush is a little better than that.
Well, let's look at them. These may or may not be what you're talking about. So here is this very uneven bristle, right? And it sort of depends on how you use these things. The one thing I wanted to mention about these other brushes, I don't know if you can tell from this image, but it looks like they're sort of hairy or fuzzy on the sides, as though they're little burrs. And if you think about what you'd want this to do is to go into the groove and sort of catch on stuff if it bent at all. It seems like a pretty amazing design, like really thoughtful. Whereas these are very smooth shafts that have just been, you know, chopped with like a pair of scissors, more or less. Like they're not clean cuts, and they're sort of mushroomed out at the bottom, right? So even if I measure, I measured the diameter of these things, which is about 100 microns. You know, they did this cut horizontally like that and made flat cylinders at the bottom or circles. But if you have this sort of smushed out head, it's even wider than 100 microns. And then you know that while you might get to the very top of the V-shaped groove, you're not getting very far into it, especially with this mushrooming. The polymer is different too. So you've got a thinner polymer, so it's more flexible and it's not as tough. But it is likely cheaper than polyamide. So if I were comparing the two so far, I would say I'd go with the old one that you can't get anymore. another brush is quite different. I don't know that they put these. Actually, I guess I do know where they put these, so I won't say. But these are pretty evenly cut. They're shorter bristles, which means that, it's unclear, but they probably are harder to bend. Depends on how soft they are. I figured out that they are, in fact, animal hair. They are advertised as goat hair brushes, and so they are, at least you know, they're animal hair, and you can't probably see it, but there's little scales like there are on our hair, which I think are pointed in the wrong direction to act as burrs, but I know with some Asian hair, they have much different scales on their hair, and if you would flip them around, so not this way, but you mounted them in the brush that way, that you can just rub your finger along them, and it's much more, your finger will grab. And so you could use those to your advantage if you were designing a brush. They did not, but they're animal hairs. And the interesting part about it is that you end up with a variety, because they're not synthetic, a variety of thicknesses, so or diameters, between 40 and 150 microns, which what I did not do is a population analysis to say, you know, there is mostly 50 micron particles. So maybe someday when I'm really bored, I'll do that. But they're cut off sort of straight at the bottom, just like the ones from the last brush. And so if you look at these, some of those would fit well into the grooves, and some of them wouldn't. And so it's hard to argue really against using this, because some of them would get in there. And since this one is actually commercially available, maybe you would use it if you can't find the other ones. So I guess the point is sort of be cognizant of what, of what you're using with brushes and why and how. A lot of people, I've noticed, when they're using them, tend to press down on the brush so that it curves on the disc. And so you're really cleaning with the side of the brush. You're not using the tips. And so depending on what brush you have, you may either need to do that or just try to gently use it so that the tips are actually trying to get into those grooves. It's your best shot in most cases of when you have heavy exudation getting into the grooves. And then the other thing I've seen people use are like polishing cloths or like lens cleaners for your glasses, very soft cloths, sometimes with soaps or surfactants. And so I sort of just said, well, what cloths might be the best to use, and what would be the caveats about using particular cloths? People are not using paper, I hope, but I put this up here to show you what my test looks like when you use something that you know you wouldn't want to use, like sandpaper, right? So my test is here's a piece of acrylic, like plexiglass, and then I put the cloth that I'm using under a weight, and then I have a machine that just does this, and it scratches. So if you have something that's super smooth, it won't scratch the plastic. If it is not smooth, if you put sandpaper on there, you would get a bunch of striations like this. And these are microscope images with like low light so that the light reflects off the scratches. So these are, you know, bad situation. You wouldn't want to use these. And this is obviously quite good. So black means there's nothing reflecting light, no scratches. So microfiber cloths seem to work really well. The kinds of things you'd clean your glasses with would work well. But what on those claws, if they've sewn the edges together and you let those threads end up in the pressure point zone, then you'll end up with scratching of the surface. So you can, I know, I think one of the vendors here had one that where you see the little zigzag cut along the edges, those are fine. These seem to not fray, and you don't need the threads. So I would just say either cut those threads off or buy ones that don't have that. And then it's not that soft synthetic is bad, but this was a used cloth, and I have no idea how long it had been used, but what I noticed is that it basically worked really well, except there were some scratches. And for the woodworkers out there, you all know that you start with one grit of sandpaper, and then you vacuum your entire shop, and then go back and use the next level, so you're not putting those grains of larger sand into the wood again, because you just scratch the woodwork, right? And that's what's going on here, that there's some particles in the cloth that are scratching the surface, even though the cloth is super soft. So the key is your cloth is only as soft as the largest particles that are trapped in it. So keep your cloth clean, and I would say refresh them often if you're one to use cloths to rub the surface of your discs. And then the glasses cleaner, which is the kind that I wipe my glasses with, were also quite soft and worked fine. And then I have a little just observation that maybe you can confirm or deny. I've noticed that several of our discs had odd patterns of exudation. And I took these discs, a light disc, a light exudation and a heavy exudation, put it under a pretty high-powered microscope at about, I don't know, 400 or 500 times magnification, and noted that the light ones, the crystals were growing only on the very surface. So you remember the top-bottom groove picture. Maybe I can go back to it quickly. I only saw crystals growing here on the light ones. And then the heavy exudation, actually, you'd see them start to like go down into the groove, and if it was really heavy, you would see a pattern where it went all the way down and back up. I can't prove that the heavy exudation didn't start here, but all the ones that I looked at that were mild exudation all started on the surface. And when we store these things, we're storing them in paper sheaths, and those paper sheaths, at least the ones that I had, were very old and brittle, much like a Pulp Fiction novel that's made out of sort of crappy paper. Crappy paper is exuding acids, and acids can cause fatty acids to, not fatty acids, but acid hydrolysis, which is how you get these fatty acids to come off of castor oil. So I have this theory that I have not proven that the paper might be starting this process, and that if we take these things out of these sheaths, so I'd be curious if you guys have tried this and it still get exudation, we may limit the amount of acid-catalyzed hydrolysis that we're getting in these and get less of this exudation. So your feedback on that would be excellent. And I think... So I don't know if you noticed, but that was what I was talking about. So this looks like it was in something that was flat and had a line across it like a paper envelope, and there's less exudation here than there is here. This thing is obviously extremely degraded, but we had somewhere this was more obvious. I just stole this picture from the first slide. So in conclusion, water-based surfactants worked pretty well. Ammonia was useful for getting these things to dissolve, the palmitic and stearic acid. Again, only using ammonia if you're trying to get these fatty acids off the surface. Not all brushes are alike, and I didn't look at all of the brushes that are out there, but you don't need a very high-power microscope to do what I did. Any university would have them, and maybe high schools if you're kind of curious about what you're using. And your synthetic cloths, that test that I did, or the cloths that you're using to scrub, this, you can also do at home pretty easily. If you want to check to see if yours has particles in it, just choose a weight, put a book on some acrylic, and rub it back and forth, and you can hold this thing up to light, and you'll be able to see if it's scratching it or not. Obviously, you don't want to do that. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Time to take a couple of questions. Steve.
Okay. Was this done on one brand or multiple brands of lacquer discs?
There's multiple brands that we looked at. The solubility tests, we only used two discs, so we didn't put this on all of the discs.
The but two discs were of the same brand or were different brands?
They were very likely different brands. Yeah, well, so maybe that's why we saw differences in the way they solubilized. Yeah. They certainly have different additives. Yeah.
The poor lacquer collector, we have these discs and we love them, and we'd like, of course, dub them, but we'd like to preserve them. You seem to hypothesize that what's starting this problem is storage in these paper sleeves. Do you think there's a way to store the disc where you can put off for decades the breakdown, the plasticizer breakdown?
Well, this is my theory, right? I have not proven that it's acid from the paper doing this. It was just a surprising discovery that I made last week. That said, yeah, you would use acid-free paper or acid-free envelopes. And I think, do you have a comment?
Yeah, go for it. Commonly known, cool and dry. It's a huge difference, cool and dry, stored in cool and dry in acid-free containers.
But is it still a ticking time bomb? I mean, you know,
everything is, yeah. Yeah.
Mike, go ahead. Well, what about the old Library of Congress lined sleeves that were developed back in the late 50s? Shield packs, right. That has a plastic.
I don't know. Do you have a comment on that?
Gene's giving one there.
Gene? Okay.
The problem with those sleeves is that, you know, some of them are warped, so you wouldn't want to put vinyl in them. But, you know, they're acid-free, so I think they would serve the purpose fine.
Yeah, I've looked at those shield packs. There's a problem with them, too. They off-gas, which means they're also dealing with the off-gassing of the lacquer. And we had certain things. I worked part-time at the Rogers and Hammerstein Archives for over 25 years, and we had gotten some material from the Library of Congress where they had sealed them and they hadn't let the labels dry. Well, they were sealed when they came up to us. Right, right. But we got ones that were sealed where you use a hot iron across it and then cut it to get in there, and there was supposedly enough room. We had problems because nothing breathed. Of course, there was mold inside because these labels were not properly dried at the time.
Yeah, clearly the current culture is to not do that with any polymeric stuff.
There is also another theory concerning it, that if a disc already has oxidized, do not attempt to clean it until you're ready to preserve it. Because what has happened is that coating will oxidize to a certain point and just hold. And in a certain way, it's preserving the disc from it being exposed to any more oxygen for the moment. And there is something, part of that also, what you were showing concerning the problem with the oxidation can also be due to pressure of how tight the discs were packed on the shelf. And the run of the disc, the lacquer composition, which company it is, it all has to deal with all sorts of variables, and also when they were stored afterwards, where they were sometimes in a box,
sure,
where they were at the end or the center in moving crates, and just from one manufacturer to the other, just a different serial number that's on there can determine whether some will oxidize and some will not.
So when you say oxidize, what are you using as evidence?
The palmitic acid syndrome.
Okay. All right.
The stripe at the edge that you showed there was definitely from an extra thickness of paper in the sleeves.
Yeah.
That is the problem with this. With
the way the sleeves are manufactured, that you have an extra layer of paper. So if you have a vertical pile, as the stuff was misstored at Northwestern before I got there, the entire weight of the pile rests on those strips. And even if they're vertically stored correctly, the extra thickness of paper makes a difference. The sleeves should be manufactured with a cutout on those flaps. What is also important is the glue on those flaps is something which is different from the rest of the surface of the sleeve.
But did you see more oxidation at those flap areas or less?
More, and the and high pressure would also be the pressure on the lacquer would
so that would help diffusion of these acids go in, or you think that's helping oxidation?
No.
I've
question concerning
we've
this.
We've got two more here in the back.
All right.
And I think we'll have to.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you for the work you're doing. I was wondering what the next steps would be if you were planning on doing a broader sample. There's been a lot of talk about different formulations for different lacquers,
yeah.
which seems to correspond to anecdotal evidence at least.
I would probably, for me anyway, I would look at the other surfactants and probably do my own best case formulation. I think that's what Culpepper is looking for. For me, rather than doing a survey of which one of these solutions dissolves differently on different types of discs or different manufacturers.
Yeah, the reason I mentioned that is because I think some of us that work with lacquers have found that a bit of what you said, that there's a certain type of deposit that seems different from everything else
yeah.
that appears in our collections happens to be maybe 5 to 10% of the discs, which may not be the biggest concern, but there's certain deposits that seem not to work with anything. And the only solution that I found is actually play them twice, which is not ideal. So.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting to try, you know, if I were able to get a very good cleaning solution. And then once I did that, the next step would be to look at, you know, where does it work, where doesn't it work within the collection. That's right.
Time for one more.
We've got some 30s recordings, which are... perhaps some kind of an acetate, not lacquer-coated disc, but primarily Titan recordings from the West Coast, which have some sort of a real hard crystalline deposit that forms on them that's not in any way greasy or anything like this, and it doesn't seem to respond well to the sort of things that you've presented here. Do you know what that is, and if there's an effective way of dealing with that?
I'll say I don't know what that in particular is, though when I looked under the microscope at the slide, these, sometimes you would see a little bit of amorphous stuff that you would call greasy, but other times it was just a field of crystals, no wax or oil on these discs. I didn't do any of that. So I didn't try to remove it, I just observed it, yeah.
Yeah.